Stand by while NCLA cuts through the noise to signal abuse of administrative power. This is Administrative Static with Mark Chenoweth and John Vecchione.
Happy New Year, everybody, and welcome to Administrative Static. I have to say, Mark Chenoweth here with John Vecchione. I have to say, John, that John Mellencamp music really gets me going every time in the lead into this show. Always just makes me want to talk administrative law, constitutional law, some of the problems that we're facing, that we're working to correct. And we have a good one to start the show with here, because at the tail end of 2021, the New Civil Liberties Alliance sued the Securities and Exchange Commission. And for those who've been following the show, you may recall that we got a big win out of the Fifth Circuit against the SEC. And no sooner did we get that win than we turned around and sued the SEC again. So there may be a wanted poster over on the walls of the SEC, Vec, for maybe not for you and me, maybe for our colleague Peggy Little. She's been at the root of
a lot of their problems. Yep.
Yes, exactly. So if there's a rogues gallery over there at the SEC, they may want her in it. But in any event, the new lawsuit against the Securities and Exchange Commission has to do with board diversity rules that for the NASDAQ stock market that the SEC has approved. And these board diversity rules, and by the way, I should mention before I forget, if this is something you're particularly interested in and you want to hear a whole hour-long discussion about the SEC and these board diversity rules, jump on to NCLA's website, nclalegal.org, go to the news and media tab, and then go down to the lunch and law panels, and you can hear a whole panel discussion, including with Peggy, with Shang Li, our other colleague who is involved with that litigation, our client, Scott Shepard, with the National Center for Public Policy Research is on that discussion. And I believe John Barry is the fourth person on that panel who is a partner over at the Boyd & Gray law firm here in town. And they are they actually brought the first lawsuit against the SEC on this question in the Fifth Circuit. And it's our lawsuit has been consolidated with theirs in the Fifth Circuit. So if you want to learn more about it, go there. But let me jump into what it's about. The board diversity rule does, and this has already been approved. It's already set to go into effect. It was approved on August 6th by the SEC. It does two things. First, it establishes a quota that companies on the NASDAQ must have at least one female member of the board of directors. So that's the first aspect of the rule. Then the second aspect of the rule is that they have to have at least one person on the board who is either a racial minority or a sexual preference minority. And so you have these various sort of separate, the gender one is separate, and then the race and sexual preference one is together. And then if you don't meet one or both of those quotas, the rule also states that the board has to publicly explain why the board does not meet these quotas. So NASDAQ is a quasi public entity. It's it has some control over the exchange that's private, but all of its rules have to be approved by the SEC. So even though the NASDAQ and the SEC might want to say that NASDAQ is a completely private entity, it still has to worry about things like the First Amendment because of its quasi-public status and because SEC is responsible for approving these rules, and the SEC can't approve rules that violate the First Amendment. But there's a more fundamental problem with these rules. Well, there's actually a few fundamental problems with these rules, but the Boyd & Gray firm has really focused on some of the problems with these rules, just in terms of trying to point out that the Constitution doesn't allow these sorts of diversity mandates. And that's really the focus of that initial lawsuit. Where NCLA has come in is to say, look, SEC doesn't have the power to pass rules like this in the first place. That if you look at the 1934 Securities Exchange Act, NASDAQ's rules have to be designed to prevent fraudulent and manipulative acts and practices, to promote just and equitable principles of trade, to remove impediments to and perfect the mechanism of a free and open market, and in general, to protect investors in the public interest. So the focus here is really on protecting investors from fraud in the market, right? That's the focus of the rules over these exchanges. And something like the board diversity rules that have been proposed don't fall neatly within any of those sort of categories. That there's no showing that the race, gender, or sexual preference of corporate directors would have any effect on protecting investors from fraud. And in fact, the 34 Act explicitly forbids NASDAQ from adopting rules that quote, regulate by virtue of any authority conferred by the Act, matters not related to the purposes of the Act. So not only does the Securities Exchange Act have this limit in terms of what the rules have to do, but it says, essentially says, you can't take your power and regulate by virtue of this authority something else that doesn't relate to the purposes of the Act, which is a, Vec, I take that to be a fairly unusual statutory provision. I can't think of too many statutes I've seen that says, here's limits on what you can do. And furthermore,
we mean it.
Yeah.
We mean it. Right. And the thing about this is it reminds me of all these things when national security is very big, people try to cram everything into national security. Whatever they want to do is national security, right? This is the SEC is doing the same thing. They want to do this diversity thing for reasons having nothing to do on whether stocks and bonds and everything else will be sold more fairly. They have other reasons for doing it, but they're going to make it a security thing, just like we'll make everything national security. Well, no, not everything's national security, and not everything helps transparency in SEC transactions.
Right. Not everything's national security and not everything's securities.
Exactly.
So, that's a great point. And I think that the rules are, so there's a second rule here that I should say before I get too far down the road here. The second rule that's part of this that was approved is this board recruiting service, so that if companies are having trouble meeting the diversity requirement in the first rule, that the NASDAQ will provide NASDAQ listed companies with access to a quote network of board ready diverse candidates. So I find it a little bit creepy, John, to think about the government having a list of people that the government approves to put on your corporate board. That's a little too fascistic for me. Government control of companies is not something that we've had in this country, and not something that we should want to have in this country. But but there's lots of questions too about that. Who decides who's board ready? Is somebody really board ready to sit on any board in America? Is there really no difference from one board to another? Is there transparency in this process, and all kinds of problems with this board ready rule as well. But suffice it to say that there isn't statutory authority for either one of these rules as far as NCLA can tell. And the idea that companies are going to be required to call their own integrity into question by explaining if they fail to meet this diversity criteria just sounds like a First Amendment problem. It sounds like compelled speech of a kind that hasn't passed muster before. You may remember just a few years ago, there was a conflict minerals rule that the SEC propounded, where companies were going to have to divulge if they couldn't for sure say that their supply chains were devoid of conflict minerals, then they had to sort of self-flagellate and say, oh, yes, we do have conflict minerals in our supply chain. And the D.C. Circuit, it didn't even have to take the Supreme Court. The D.C. Circuit, which is usually very pro-regulatory, they said, no, you're not going to get away with that sort of compelled speech regime. And this looks like the same thing to me, Vic. This looks like a compelled speech regime. Now it's around diversity instead of around conflict minerals, but looks like the same kind of forced speech. I think it will meet the same fate. And the lawsuit that we have brought, I should mention a little bit more about our client. The National Center for Public Policy Research is another nonprofit organization here in Washington, D.C. And they go around and buy shares in a bunch of public companies, not just NASDAQ listed companies, but New York Stock Exchange listed companies as well. And what those stock holdings allow them to do ordinarily, and what the Free Enterprise Project over there does a lot of, is they'll file suggestions for things to be voted on, proxy votes to be voted on at board meetings, because there are a lot of lefty groups out there that try to get corporate boards to adopt all kinds of lefty proposals. And so NCPPR said, well, we could do the same thing from the other side of the aisle, or at least force both issues on the ballot, that if you're going to be considering one issue, then you could be considering the exact opposite of that issue as well. And so that's what
NCPPR nothing should. And nothing board members like more than shareholder proposals.
Yes, not a popular thing. But but for our purposes, this stock ownership also gives NCPPR standing, we believe, to sue over these NASDAQ rules. And so we're very excited about this new lawsuit. As I say, Peggy Little has had great success against the SEC in the Fifth Circuit recently. And so we're gonna capitalize on that and see if we can do it again and get something else done here to keep the SEC in line and put constitutional constraints on the administrative state.
Welcome back to Administrative Static, and we have another new case that NCLA filed in Virginia, and this one has to do with vaccines again and some of the irrationality of what the school administrators are doing to young people. As we all know, in the first year of the pandemic, schools closed down and they had what they called virtual learning, which for many students meant no learning at all. It's had a devastating effect, particularly on lower income folks and kids who had learning disabilities in order to get an education. But they shut the schools down and then they had virtual learning for a while. And now they have masking requirements in Virginia. If you go to school, like my boys do, you have to wear masks in school. All of this is obviously disruptive to learning and is very controversial, some of it, and some of the vaccine matters are controversial. But we have a case of a little girl, child who has had COVID. Her family, they all had COVID. They all got it, mild cases, but they all have tested for antibodies. And as we've tried to explain on this show many times, there is no transmissibility issue. One of the reasons you have vaccine requirements in Virginia, as we do, we have it for chickenpox and measles and things of that nature, as most states do. Two things are going on there. First, a lot of those vaccines stop transmission. If you get a smallpox vaccine, that makes sure that you can't transmit it either. But that's not the case with these EUA, these emergency use authorization vaccines that we have. Number one, they haven't gone through everything, but they're also really designed. Their main function and the thing that they do well is make sure that you don't get hospitalized, you don't get really sick. So it is a huge benefit to you to get the vaccine, particularly if you've never had COVID. But it doesn't mean that you then can't transmit it to other people. That's not how this type works, whereas other vaccines it does. We have a student who who's just 7 years old and has had to kicked out of school and quarantined again and again and again. And these are 14 days quarantines where you're just kept out of school. So we've sued on behalf of her, the child and parents to say, hey, look, you can't keep doing this because you don't do this to vaccinated students. And this student is of no more risk to anyone than a vaccinated student. And we have some interesting matters in this case in that.
Can I just jump in on one point, Vic? I think it's 14 days on the initial, you know, if you have COVID, then you have to stay out for 14 days. But I think that.
Yes. And then if you run into someone, it's 10 days.
It's 10 days. Yes.
But that's still a lot of time. Just a lot of time into someone and you haven't. Now, this, again, I banged this drum quite a bit. But the other thing is we don't have testing. I went all over the place right last week getting a test for somebody. I had to go to three different places till I got one. And now you can't get them for love or money. But nonetheless. So that's a lot of time. First, if you had it, you're at 14 days. Then if you're in contact with someone, 10 days. And under FCPS's quarantine policy, a fully vaccinated student who is identified as potential close contact may return to school immediately upon verification that the student is vaccinated and asymptomatic. But someone who's had COVID, the same things apply and they can't come back. And this is completely not treating equal things equally. So we've described the vaccines and how they work and how natural immunity works. And we talk about the fact that that there is some evidence that if you've had prior COVID, some of the vaccines can seem to have a higher risk for you if you take them. So we have moved. We note that it's violative of the Equal Protection Clause because that clause of both the state and federal constitutions prevent unequal treatment of equal people in equal situations. And then there's also in Virginia a right to an education and a right for parental control of that education in your health. And these are being violated here. And then finally, there's a due process and unconstitutional conditions, meaning that what they've done here is put so many burdens on a person who's already had the disease that makes no sense under both the federal and the Virginia constitutions.
Well, they're trying to coerce you into getting the vaccine by making it really inconvenient for you if you don't. I think that's the way I look at it.
That is. Well, they say that's what they're doing. They're doing that on purpose. But the real question is who gets to control the kids? And one thing we did have, we had a big election over whether or not you have any say in your children's education. And Terry McAuliffe said some.
Was that an issue in the campaign, John?
I understand that it was an issue in the campaign. And I believe that he. He spoke with too much candor. Let's put it that way.
this was the campaign for governor in Virginia for those who are not local to the area.
So I do think that this issue is going to come up. And then the final, I said the last one, but we do have one which our listeners will hear, which is these vaccines are not. They're not. They're not like the chickenpox vaccines or others that have gone through the full federal FDA approval.
And right. they're still safe
and effective, the law that allows emergency use also allows you not to take it. It's an option, it can't be made mandatory. So the law itself that allows this this quick access to these vaccines, which has been very useful, has been sort of mutated by the government functionaries and the administrative state to make it coercive. And that's not what its purpose was, and that's not what it says. So, and for the life of me, why the FDA hasn't approved these things when people are making this argument all over the country, I don't know. It's been a long time now. But the fact of the matter is that the law doesn't allow you to require this because it gives you the right of refusal, of you know, informed consent. So we have this complaint, and we'll see where it goes, but it does hit on a lot of things that are going on, because it's not just the federal administrative state that can coerce people into doing things they don't want to do, but it's also the local administrative state. And as Mark and I discussed in our last episode, the public health authorities have not been forthright in many occasions. They've said things for political reasons that they can't back up, and they want to do things administratively for their own convenience that undermine people's faith in what they have to say. There was a statement the other day that, you know, a lot of people have the view that are pro-vaccine, and this would be Youngkin's view, I think, very pro-vaccine, but anti-mandate.
Youngkin being the incoming governor of Virginia.
The incoming governor of Virginia. And again, with the EUAs, it's supposed to be an option. It gives you more ability to protect yourself, but it allows you to make the decision. And I think it was a wise law. I really do. I think it's caused a lot of good. But then they it's been taken over, and they say, oh, well, this isn't the federal government making you do it, or you don't have a right to sue under that. We just put those words in there for no reason. They have no effect on us if we don't want to listen to them.
Well, it's not clear it's not clear the statute would have passed if they had said back in 2002 or 3, whenever that law was passed, oh, hey, if we approve something on an emergency use basis, we can jam it into your arm without your permission, or we can force the medicine down your throat even if you don't want to take it. I'm not sure that statute would have passed Congress.
Yeah, and I think it probably wouldn't, because you have, and it's not a left or right thing. There's a lot of different types of interests here. There's the patient advocate groups, which are neither left nor right, that are sort of an intermediate pressure group on patients' rights and access, and then there's also the libertarians and then there's the folks, the doctors,
groups,
the doctors who want to be able to inform their patients of things and not have to have them forced into things the doctors don't think are good for that patient. So there's a lot of non-political reasons it wouldn't have left-right reasons that it wouldn't have passed. That has to do with the coalitions you have to get together to do this sort of thing. And I would say even the pharmaceutical companies would probably have balked at it, because they don't want to be seen as, they did this so that their drug would be immediately taken when it hadn't been fully proven, right? They don't want to hear that. So I think that that you're absolutely right, Mark. And I hope that this case will draw attention to it, and that this student won't be kept out of school any longer than necessary. And at least be treated like other people who are vaccinated, because since we started doing this, Mark, I haven't seen anything that dissuades me that natural immunity is worse than any of these vaccines. As far as transmissibility and as protection goes, there really isn't, nothing has emerged to make me more concerned about that.
No, and the more data that comes out, the stronger it looks for natural immunity, and that maybe that'll change with Omicron, but everything I've seen shows that it's at least as strong.
I think that's right. Well, we'll be back in a little bit.